The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Football Weekly today. City win effing old controversial game at St James's despite Newcastle having an absolute screamer, for which he later apologised. City go top, but it's Nasri stop. Elsewhere, Stoke Liverpool rule Britannia as SAS return. Hashtag if Andy McNabb did match reports. While West Ham win and get the return of Andy Carroll as well. And David Moyes no longer in crisis, now in Cagliari. Plus Spurs Palace, the biggest punch and miss since Audley Harrison. With all the news from abroad, Sid on Atletico Madrid, Barca, the Ballon d'Or, transfer targets and more, plus Serie A, the incredible Sassuolo Milan, four goals by a teenager, and Allegri out on his ear. Who will take over at the Rossoneri? Well, that's very much the question. All of that, plus an extra bumper postbag in this Football Weekly. Well, if I wasn't excited enough already, how about this for a lineup? Slightly enthralling Paul McInnes.
Hello, James.
Hi. Greg Bukowski.
Hi, James.
All right, Greg.
Hello.
And Sean Ingle.
Hello, James.
Hi, Sean. Apparently, producer Ben has got a bet, ironically, on with you that you're not going to talk about gambling today.
That's right.
But that's crazy. That's like having Paul McInnes on and not talking about story arcs or...
You've still got lots of stats, though, haven't you? There might be one or two stats.
All right. I have to say, I came in and saw Sean this morning. I was congratulating him on his new role as senior sports writer at The Guardian, which is great. You know, I remember
you
this guy.
You senior sports writer at The Guardian?
Well, there's one of three. Yeah.
All right, okay.
I remember the days when he used to come into the office in baggy trekkie bottoms and sit there eating cold baked beans out of a tin, right? So right. I'm very proud of him. And he says, well, yeah, that's fair enough, but have you read my column today? And I hadn't read the column, so I went down and read the column, and it is quite literally 85% statistics. It's right. Like... one paragraph about Ashley Cole's pass completion, his number of sprints, his number of assists. Very, very informative.
Oh, great, Sean. Well, let's talk about that in depth a little bit later on. Let's start, though, with extraordinary events at St James's Park as Newcastle took on Man City. Not the best of games, but plenty of talking points here. The biggest one being that Cheick Tiote goal. Yay, nay, Sean?
Yay for me. I thought... I don't think the keeper would have stopped that. I think it was, and I don't necessarily think the players that were running back were interfering.
Well, they were
a little bit slow getting back, arguably, but I'd have given it personally.
Yeah, it was a bit mystifying, wasn't it, Greg?
I just think that rule needs simplifying myself.
How would you simplify it?
Well, I just don't know how a referee is supposed to be able to compute in his mind, watching a shot fly past him at 80 miles an hour and then look at three players that are kind of lingering in the background and make a decision as to whether they would interfere and whether they were in
Joe
Hart's
way. But they were in the background and they weren't in Joe Hart's way. And from where he was...
No, but he sees somebody move away from the ball. If you've got to move away from the ball, are you not interfering? You know, and then to consult the linesman, who's probably the worst possible person to decide whether somebody's in the way of the goalkeeper because, you know, he's not seeing things from a vertical point of view, just seems a bit...
Yes, unless he thought that Gouffran touched it and maybe thought the linesman would have seen, but it does seem. And from the second that the ball went in, he was looking up at the linesman as if he thought there was something the linesman was going to be able to bring to this particular discussion. A mistake.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a tough call as well, because, as you say, not only was the ball flying at 80 miles an hour, there was lots of different agents in play. But I think the fact that Joe Hart didn't dive for that ball is telling. And
what way?
Well, I think he says that he was impeded from diving, but. He should have dived.
Why was he impeded from diving?
Because Gouffran was, he either thought Gouffran was in the position where he was going to dive to try and save, or could have been in the position where he was going to dive and save. But he didn't. He chose not to dive. And I think that kind of says more about what he actually thought were his chances of stopping that.
Right. Well, that was one controversial decision. Another one was the Yanga Mbiwa tackle on Nasri, which looks like it's ruled Nasri out for a sustained period of time.
Absolutely. Straight red for me.
Do you think there's a connection between Alan Pardew's rage on the touchline and that tackle from Yanga Mbiwa? Or is that a little bit too much to read into?
Well, that's
if your manager goes bonkers on the sideline, does it not G the players up beyond the acceptable?
Well, yeah, and you can imagine he was also G'ing them up at half-time in the dressing room, which I think is interesting in one sense, because he can obviously communicate this the Anglo-Saxon kind of fury to a largely Gallic squad, which shows they've bonded at least. Certainly but yeah, it was quite reckless, a lot of the play. Kabaye's tackles in the second half were pretty horrible as well.
Right. Beyond that, though, and Man City had a little bit of fortune, perhaps, but given that the two things that were regarded as potentially stopping them being runaway champions this year were A, Hart's goalkeeping, and B, their away form, are they now sorted?
Well, I think it's their first clean sheet, I think, since drawing with Stoke in September, so that's a positive thing. And they've now taken 28 points from the last 10 games, so clearly they're flying. I wouldn't say they're necessarily sorted, because City have still got quite a tough run in. They've only played one of the top seven teams away, and they lost to Chelsea 2-1. While, for example, if you look at Liverpool and Chelsea, they've played most of the big sides away from home, so they should have an easier run in. So certainly, right. I would not say City are sorted. They're favourites, and rightly so. They're playing very well. They're not necessarily home and hosed.
Oh, OK, the last two away games. The draw at Blackburn, which they've got the replay of coming up this Wednesday, and this game in which they were a little bit fortunate. What about Newcastle, though? Four defeats in a row. A lot of talk of players heading out the door.
And, yeah, not scored in 280 minutes is of it? Premier League football. Yeah, ooh. So having played... I mean, it's not surprising the way people were sort of writing them off a little bit at the start of the season, then they hit a run of form. Perhaps understandable that they're going to regress slightly, you know, but they're still probably end up finishing 7th, 8th, 9th, something like that.
Yeah, they've still got a very strong midfield with lots of options in the midfield, but they've only really got that one striking option. And Remy, when was the last time he scored? His red-hot form coincided with their red-hot form and without him. But they're looking at Luke de Jong, is that right, on loan? So
Remy Cabana as well, out of Montpellier, who are 1 point above the drop in France.
Oh.
All right. But, you know, by all accounts, a good player. If that goes through, we'll get some French opinion on that. But in the meantime, let's say City go top. Of course, Arsenal are playing tonight away at Aston Villa. Chelsea, meanwhile, staying 1 point behind Man City with their victory away at Hull. I've got a note here. It says, Hazard is boss, which I think pretty much... Well, sums up his performance.
Yeah, well, Hazard has been fantastic in the last, I'd say, four or five games, and Chelsea have improved a lot. But I find the most interesting thing is after Chelsea got beat by Stoke and then they got beat by Sunderland, I think, in the Capital One Cup, Mourinho, he came out and said, I'm going to have to change things, you know, we're going to be more defensive. And they went and bolted the door at Arsenal. It was a dire game, that, but they, you know, they were defensive in that game. And since then, they've conceded one goal, I think, against Liverpool, and they've won, you know, five on the bounce. So he's basically said something, and he's done exactly what he said. And it's very impressive to be able to just kind of tinker with his team slightly, as he has done. And I think by putting David Luiz into midfield, and, you know, he has actually done exactly what he meant to do. And now Chelsea look more like the Chelsea that he managed, you know, in his last stint there, than the lot who were conceding a lot of goals at the beginning of the season.
Maybe I'm overreading this, but I always imagine that was what Mourinho intended from the very beginning anyway. And I mean, if you look at the way they played away at United right at the start of the season, that was incredibly defensive. And the way he's handled Mata, who is the one kind of creative player who doesn't really do a defensive shift. I think he's wanted this from the beginning, and now he's got it. But it's interesting that those three... I've never been that taken with Hazard myself. I don't know. I may be wrong, but it's him and Coutinho for me. I always thought they flattered to deceive.
What did you think of it? Did you see this game?
Yeah, I thought he made decisive actions in the telling moments, and that was actually more than being flairful and exciting to watch. But just when he had that opportunity, he made sure he got the right outcome.
He's done that, you know, quite a lot over the last, let's say, seven or eight games.
Sure.
Particularly away at Sunderland, he was brilliant as well. And yeah, his final ball and he's, you know, he picks when he decides to shoot. He you know, it's the right decision. He doesn't just kind of, he's not wishy washy about his decision making.
Until his goal, though, or until actually the end of the first half, it had looked. Hull's game, El Mahabedi on Ashley Cole. There's a good chance to bring your article in here, Sean, because you're talking about the role of the fullback, and a lot of people commenting on how Mahabedi was really enjoying the best of it against the formerly world's greatest left back, Ashley Cole.
Well, I thought Cole had a decent enough game, really? To be honest with you. Yeah, I mean, my point rather is that the role of the fullback has changed. It's much more attacking now, and Cole physically is not the player he was. He doesn't sprint as much as he used to. He's not as fast. And also, it's now this emphasis on attack. Cole has never been, and I think we have the image in our head that he's this rampage up and down, you know, but it's actually his final ball has never
been
that great.
Not the image I have of Ashley Cole in my head.
But. Or perhaps. Anyway, quiz question for you. Steve Bruce has now lost 13 times against Chelsea. Only one team has he lost more games to.
So Steve Bruce has lost 13 times
to Chelsea,
but there's a team he's lost even more games to.
Manchester United.
Very good. 14 times.
Right. Oh, anyway, so I was saying about how Hazard's terrific and how Chelsea are now all about the Hazard, basically. But according to French sources, there's this big thing in a French paper on Friday how he supposedly has told one of his teammates that he wants to move to PSG, who might just be able to scrape together a big pot of cash for him at the end of this season. Wow, that would be quite a killer, wouldn't it?
Mourinho said he wouldn't sell him under any circumstances.
Right.
But, I mean, whether that means anything.
Don't know. Because these days, clubs are digging in their heels, aren't they, successfully? All right, in the meantime, De Bruyne, I'm not sure if that's gone through yet, but it's about to go through to Wolfsburg, so they can get about $17 million, which will be about half the amount that they need to pay to Benfica for Nemanja Matic. Can you talk me through this one, anyone? Because I'm thinking Matic, because he was there, wasn't he? He played twice, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's just indicative of this whole Chelsea thing. It's just there's just money to spare and just.
So they had this player basically,
yeah.
And he kind of sat around for a bit. They didn't really use him, and then they sent him to Benfica as part of the David Luiz deal. And how long ago was that? 2 years ago?
3 years ago.
And now they're gone, crikey, actually, we want him back for $30 million.
Because we need that guy, because David Luiz isn't entirely reliable.
Right.
It's happening a lot more in football, isn't it, with the bigger clubs now. With Pogba as well is being linked back with United, and they've had him in the past. And even Tom Ince being linked with Liverpool again, having had him as a young player and let him go out.
Yeah, I just think it's just when Chelsea can take one of the best young wide players in world football, buy him for however much it was, $7 million, and just not use him at all, and then still make a massive profit on it. It doesn't seem just to me for some reason.
Who are we talking about?
De Bruyne.
Oh right, yes, right, okay. Oh. I'm not sure. Wright Phillips is pretty. right, okay, right. Anyway, so Chelsea get that win at Hull. That's a significant win, isn't it?
It's a big win.
And Arsenal playing at Villa Monday evening. Meantime, Man City top of the pile. They may be getting the headlines with their 59 goals and that. But Liverpool...
51 goals.
51, which is less, but not that much less, Craig.
No. And they went to Stoke, where Liverpool have had an awful record over the previous few years. And I think that's a game that they would have lost in recent years, having gone 2-0 up and then come back to concede two before half-time. And I do think there was a lot of fortune in...
The penalty.
Well, in the penalty. And also, the first two goals that Liverpool scored were... They didn't have much luck against Chelsea and Manchester City, and I think they got that luck back in this game. Because
why were the first two goals lucky?
Well, the first one, Sissoko's shot was going over to Manchester or something out of the corner of the Britannia Stadium, and, kind of got the most wicked deflection you'll see.
All right, that was fair enough. But Suarez
benefited from some very
poor
defense.
Suarez's first was pretty good, though, didn't you think?
Yeah,
sniffing around.
He did what he's good at. But, yeah. I mean, Shawcross and, forget who it was.
The goalie, the one who's not...
Well, there's two defenders cocked up, basically, and Liverpool benefited from that.
But also, Suarez was scaring the living daylights out of them, forced them into these errors.
Yeah, I suppose there's that as well.
Right. It was Jack Butland in goal, point out, please, again, with the facts.
Yeah, well done, Ben.
Yeah.
But in the second half, after Liverpool got the penalty, I think it was a very Liverpool performance this season, in that they never looked convincing at the back, but going forwards, they just always look dangerous. Raheem Sterling is really growing as a player this season. I think he now looks very wily when he plays. He doesn't look naive anymore, and he won that penalty, and he is also he's very tricky and sneaky as well as a player, and I think he's becoming more important. And then Sturridge, to bring Sturridge off the bench, I thought there was going to be flakes of rust coming off him, and it was just completely smooth from the moment he came on. And the way he played Suarez in for the goal was fantastic.
Sure,
and then his little bit of juggling to score the fifth was really, really very good as well.
Brilliant.
So, I think Liverpool are in with a very, very good shout now of finishing in the top four, which is still the aim.
Right. Greg, what do you think about the thin controller, as Paul dubbed him?
I just don't see Gerrard in that position. I didn't think he had a very good game myself. I thought he gave the ball away three or four times. He lacks control in that position. And he's always been better, I think, in a wider position or behind the striker for Liverpool. And when he's been in the middle, he's capable of giving the ball away more than other players. I think Liverpool, with Joe Allen, Henderson and Lucas in the midfield three, looked much more settled. None of them could say that they've got any more status at the club than each other. So, it's kind of, it's a very... There's just a much better balance with those two. I think when Gerrard's there, I think the other players look to him.
Right.
And now he's, you know, he needs to learn to be more economical in possession than he is.
Would you rather not see him in the starting lineup then?
Well, this is going to be a very difficult decision for Brendan Rodgers. At some point, he's going to have to make that.
But you're saying that the midfield plays better without
him?
Yeah.
So, but it's a very difficult one. When you've got a player who's, you know, he is like a living Liverpool legend who is the England captain as well and your club captain, it comes to a point where you've got to make a decision. Does he bring more by being in that team and the influence he has to it than his actual qualities as a player? And I'd argue that in that match, I didn't think the match was a very good game. As much as it was 5-3, I thought there was a lot of mistakes and it wasn't brilliant. I thought Henderson didn't look as good as he has done in previous games when Gerrard's not been there, and possibly because I just think he maybe feels a bit cowed under Gerrard's presence.
All right, tough decisions awaiting. It's a George Osborne paradigm, isn't it? Okay. More Premier League in a second. First, a little bit of music. Hey, we haven't had whatever it is that you've got up your woolen sleeve.
Yeah.
You and producer Ben cooking something up there, Paul McInnes. None of the rest of us know what it is.
Well, it's just the most fecund time of year for me on the podcast is when you're away on holiday. I'm always on with Max Rushton.
Well, yeah, you've actually hosted this in the past, haven't you?
I have. I did it very well. I did it. It was a very somber one.
Great, yeah.
It was a very somber one around Fabrice Muamba, and I did it with a gravity, but also a lightness of touch.
Right.
But so Max Rushton and I, we have a relationship.
Ah.
And I can confirm that he's not going to be covering for you on your ski trip this year.
Yay.
Heard it straight from the horse's
mouth. I mean, hang on, I'm saying yay about the ski trip, not about Max Rushton not being here. Can I just clear that up right now?
But secondly, I went to see a film last week, because you know I like film.
Yep.
And it's called Svengali, and it's coming out in
a few
months.
What happened in the middle, Paul?
Well, what happens in the middle
is... No, spoilers. Anyway, so go on.
So I'm there, and it's kind of one of these, it's a Brit comedy, which may set alarm bells ringing immediately, but there's everybody who's anybody is in it, in British stuff, you know, from Maxine Peake, Martin Freeman, Matt Berry, all these funny types, and Max Rushton.
Is he in it?
He's in it as himself, as Soccer AM's Max Rushton.
Oh.
And so he was there also at the screening, and he was very nice to me, said hello and everything, and saved me a seat next to him in the screening room.
Right.
So that he could kind of like every 5 minutes go, it's coming now, it's coming nearly there. So, right, okay, so I hope it's going to be all right. I hope it's going to be. So, what do you think? What do you think? And he was very good, I have to say, playing himself, he's excellent. But I thought the film just kind of wasn't exactly scintillating and not particularly funny. But at the end of the screening, Max was determined that he would tell me again and again that he thought the film was very good, I presume in the hope that I would respond in kind.
Right. Crikey. That's how it works, eh, with these film review things?
I thought it was more just touching, actually, that he was a little bit anxious that it wasn't that good and he wanted me to say it was.
Right. Well, we're all seeking affirmation, aren't we?
Oh, no, I have not.
Man.
I hope I've not. I hope I've done a heartfelt personal recommendation for Max, because I think he's...
But
I
you said he was good in it.
He's good
film.
In it.
It was the others that let them down.
It was the absence of jokes in the comedy that was the problem, I thought.
Right, Paul. Interesting. Meanwhile, in the Premier League, relegation. Crikey, it's got awfully tight, because you had two of the bottom three winning, one against... Sunderland beat Fulham, of course, in cracking fashion. Palace lost, and West Ham won at Cardiff. So Cardiff have dropped into the bottom three. Now Sunderland are off the bottom, and you've got the bottom eight teams and are separated by only 4 points. Ay caramba. Lots to talk about here. West Ham's win at Cardiff, that was massive.
It was a huge win. Yeah, huge. And Allardyce really did get a bounce back performance from his players, and I don't know, maybe he was so close to being sacked that they almost saw him like he'd been sacked, and it was like having that new manager effect.
Because you think?
He was kind of back from the dead, and he's getting Andy Carroll back at just the right time now. And that, you know, came on as a substitute and
set up Noble for the second.
And they'd gone down to 10 men at that point, and they really did fight for the manager, which did, you know, if you looked at Fulham when Hull almost got sacked, it was this was a completely different team with players who obviously believe in Big Sam.
Right.
I think that's right. I mean, we were talking about this and during the FA Cup and stuff, that, you know, there was no the absence of tackles from the from West Ham, very much unlike an Allardyce side. So he got that back. Watching that game, there was not really much quality on the part of West Ham, and certainly Cardiff contributed to their own downfall in both goals and had lots of chances to score themselves.
Well, my question was, did Cardiff play really badly? Was it just that Adrian had a worldie? Because he did have a great game, didn't he?
Well, he had a worldie, and Fraser Campbell seemed to make the wrong decisions on a couple of quite attractive crosses.
Is it that thin line in football between success and failure?
Yeah, and, you know, listening to Solskjaer after the match, he seemed to be reasonably calm about it, which, I mean, it's only his first league game, is that right?
Yeah.
So... He might be, but I think there's actually a muchness about most of these sides in the bottom eight, most of them being quite bad.
Was there actually quite a fat line between success and failure in the case of Fulham and Sunderland and the Black Cats rampaging 4-1 win at Craven Cottage?
Well, again, Fulham started the better side, had a few chances, and then there was some smart play by Adam Johnson for that free kick and some terrible goalkeeping. Mm. And
a poignant hat-trick from Adam Johnson.
No, I don't buy that myself.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's poignant, isn't it? Because it's still like a...
What could have been?
Yeah.
People are talking him up in today's papers about, you know, Walcott missing Brazil. Adam Johnson coming, but I think you need more than one great performance. You know, he's obviously improved in the last...
How old's Adam Johnson? 24, 25? I mean, I do think there's still... the possibility there that he could have, you know, second good game this season, a bit of self-reflection, and he does seem to have the raw attributes of a good footballer. He's got skill, and he's more direct than a lot of other wingers, which I think my
City mates never, who'd be watched him week in, week out, never liked him. He said he was like a clear rung below the rest of the Man City squad, and you know, I think there's better. I'd rather have Townsend. But.
All right. Well, the other big news down the bottom was Crystal Palace, who I confidently predicted would win at Spurs. And I have to say, my prediction was right. It was just Jason Puncheon who was wrong. Had he put that penalty away, we'd have been looking at, you know, vindication for Jimbo here. But absolutely extraordinary. And one of the most exciting bits of the weekend, really, that skied spot kick.
How bad was it? I mean, is it up there with the Yap Stams and
I'd say
Pat Nevins?
I can't think of one that's worse.
Neymar's. Neymar's. You know what I'd say is about that though. Neymar's went about 10 yards over the bar, but at least you thought Neymar was probably trying to do something clever there to score. Yeah. With punching, he wasn't even trying to do something clever.
When was this Neymar one?
2 or 3 years ago. Oh, okay, is that right. One? And then Pat Nevins. Remember Pat? Have you seen Pat Nevins in 1984? He just passes it to the goalkeeper. There's a lot of awful penalties, but then...
But to be so wildly off target, that's
the thing. And punching was up, you know, he was just trying to do probably a meat and veg penalty, whereas the other two were trying to do something a bit clever.
But I love the reaction afterwards where he sees him under his breath, oh my God, and it's just that you can tell he's just both absolutely shocked and incredibly upset with himself.
Right. Well, he was quite upset on Monday with Neil Warnock,
yes.
But we can't actually say what he said about Neil Warnock because we might get super libel because he said some very bad things. Interestingly, The Independent printed his tweets in full, which is also interesting because I think Neil Warnock writes for The Independent, so it's very much ball in your court, Mr. Warnock. And court being the opposite word, some of the things he said there. Anyway, just to romp through some more Premier League fun.
Hey, just to say about your prediction about Palace and Spurs is that, you know, Palace did have a good first half, but Spurs had an excellent second half.
All right, fair enough.
They're playing really at full tilt.
That's Sherwood, eh?
And this I see in Jamie Redknapp's must-read column in the Daily Mail.
He was hard-hitting and objective about his chump at Tim Sherwood.
Yes, that's true, but he was saying that Sherwood gave the first Premier League start to Benteleb. Nicholas Benteleb, is it?
Have you just opened the Benteleb Daily Mail in this pod?
Yeah, I have. I get it paid on Guardian account, so I haven't technically bought it myself.
I can feel myself being judged.
So Nabil Bentaleb made his first start, and he made more passes than anybody else in the Premier League at the weekend.
You read
and
that in
competed.
That paper.
Okay.
What's also quite interesting about Spurs and appearing to have such a terrible season, they're only 2 points off fourth position and 7 points off the title.
How is that possible?
Well, I think perhaps AVB did a little better than we all thought, and it was only the results of those two, you know, hammerings against City and against Liverpool that, you know, I mean, they weren't firing, but I think they were a bit unlucky with AVB. They often didn't score early in games, and they were so they perhaps you think Spurs and Ainsley might be a better counter-attacking side than attacking side. And clearly, Ainsley had his faults as well. He stuck too much to the high line. Soldado, he should have given perhaps another guy a chance, brought back Adebayor. But they weren't as bad as people made them out to be.
I don't think they were ever even below United at any point, were they? Maybe once this season, the worst. But it was the gravity of those results.
When they were getting that way, though. Towards the end, they were actually playing badly, and the sterility that the fans were kind of like obsessing about was quite apparent by the end there.
All right, anyway, and Tim Sherwood, anything but sinister. He's very virile, isn't he, in his touchline performances and his post-game press conferences saying, nah, we don't need no more players. And I think everyone's quite excited by that. I know I am. Anyway, a Man United win. And look at that, no Van Persie, no Rooney, but very much Welbeck and Yanisai. Be interesting to see how their one-game recovery fares when they face Chelsea next.
Yeah, I thought United were still... They still showed some of the fragility they've shown this season.
That's true, actually.
Well, in the first half against Swansea. Yeah. I mean, they don't... In games they've played when they've done badly, neither team scored. There's just been this inertia in the first half. And I think under Ferguson, they were always much more... proactive, and I know it's a bit of a cliche to say David Moyes is a reactive manager because that's how Everton played, but they really, like, there were times when they were just standing off Swansea as if to say, oh come on, what have you got?
And Swansea had something like 70% of possession, didn't they?
That's United's low. United only had 38.6% possession. That's their lowest since 2006-07.
Swansea's crossing was awful in that match. Had it not been, they got some decent balls into the box, and United could have found themselves in trouble in that match as well.
Right, well, it's going to be an interesting game then at Stamford Bridge this weekend. Zaha to Cardiff, that's still not happened. Nani to Lisbon, Anderson to Fiorentina is the deal they're talking up in Italy. And of course, David Moyes turned up, to everyone's great surprise, at the Sant'Elia Stadium. There were only about three people there. He was one of them. On Sunday to see Cagliari Juventus. And much discussion about who he was there to see. Probably David Astori of Cagliari, he's a centre-back. Or maybe it was Marchisio. Could have been Marchisio of Juventus.
Juventus wouldn't sell him, would they? A homegrown talent?
Marchisio? Yeah, I think they might, actually. Because he's not really got a place in there. And they don't want to let go of Vidal. And I think it would take more money than Moyes has got. And I think same story for Pogba, where the real danger is very much that PSG lot. Everton, you probably saw this, Paul.
Yeah,
2-0
well,
against Norwich.
Yeah.
Hats off to Barry.
Yeah, well, I think they all did enough. They weren't really asked to do all that much. I just don't understand that. Again, our fans have been going on for ages, play two up front. We played two up front away from home against Everton, got absolutely none of the ball. We just overran in midfield. Barry was encouraged, to the extent that Barry was encouraged to start playing, box to box. And you can hear. Our esprit de corps is not great at the moment. And of all the teams fighting and kind of pulling out these odd results, we've hardly done it this season. We beat West Brom away, we beat Stoke away,
haven't Norwich just beaten teams around them though? That's been the thing.
Well, we did, and then we lost to Fulham on Boxing Day, and that's a massive, I think, increasingly kind of massive result. I think we've got to get to 38 points or whatever. We play basically the top four in our final four games.
Ooh.
So that leaves us with about 13-14 games in order to get 18 points. It's a big ask, and players are sniping at each other, and increasingly Houghton's decisions are... He was always a guy who played the same team, and fans didn't like him for that. But now he's chopping and changing. We do have injuries, but he's chopping and changing formation, personnel. And, Everton might change personnel, but they don't change the formation and they don't change the way they play.
Right.
And, they didn't have all that many clear-cut chances, but... They took the ones they did, and they didn't really have to try hard.
Play Hull next.
Yeah.
And
who do? Norwich?
Norwich, yeah.
Right, but you got Fulham as well in the cup.
Yeah.
Tuesday.
Yeah.
And then Hull, that's a huge game. You're only 2 points off the drop, Paul, as I expect you probably knew without me telling you.
3 points off the very bottom, in fact.
Oh, crikey, that's a bit rough. And what about Everton picking up Aidan McGeady? Is that one of those special signings?
It's a nominal fee, is that right?
Is that right?
I think if it's a nominal fee, it's a special signing, yeah, for sure.
Because he's a bit... bit like Adam Johnson, but a bit more successful.
I found that a bit of an odd signing.
Do you?
Well, just because they've got, in the kind of attacking midfield players, they're not sure. So I mean, Deulofeu's got an injury at the moment, but he should be back. Osman is coming, and he's been very good. I know they've got Barkley, who's injured.
Right, but he's more of a wide fellow.
He's a wide man.
He'll play in front of Coleman, presumably.
Martinez has said that's what he wants. He says he can play either left or right, and he's happy to have him left or right, and that he's very good at, he understands the space. Right. In that role very well. Oh, so he's obviously, nice. He already worked out what he is. You know, and I think about Morales, I'm a big fan of Morales. So right. I like all the players who are kind of quite doff and don't like the players who are brilliant. But like Morales has been inconsistent, had a good game on Saturday. Mm. But, you know, if it's a bit more competition on those wide places, you might be pushing on the others too.
But McGeady, when he was coming through at Celtic, was regarded as very much, well, the sky was the limit. And, and then it didn't happen for him.
And then
is Martinez the man to unlock that talent, do you think?
Quite possibly. I'm just surprised that he came back to a club as big as Everton. I thought he might come back to the Premier League and join a relegation scrap or something, given that he hasn't, you know, set
It's probably a step up on Naismith, though.
Mm. But then I still think, you know, play Morales in.
Right. Well, Jelovic, of course, has freed up a spot on the roster by going to Hull.
Mm. Mm.
Okay. They've now got an exciting strike partnership. Jelovic, who I think scored one goal in 2013, up front with the...
Sagbo.
Mm. No, well, yes, Sagbo, I think, has got three this season. But no, I was going to mention the other fella, Danny Graham, who I think got two in 2013.
Aye.
Might have got those the wrong way around.
I like the fact that the guy who's playing in the number 10 for Hull, that's George Boyd, isn't it, who used to play for Peterborough. Mm. Is that right? They used to be the kind of long-haired, sort of slightly throwback 1970s, kind of can't quite pigeonhole him. And he's turning in half-decent performance in the Premier League. There quite impressed.
All right. Southampton, West Brom. That was 1-0 to Saints. We'll talk about that in a second or two with Sid. First, let's go postal. Del Boy 2006. Boy, this was a post. Last week, if you missed it, we were talking about how the clubs might rebel against the idea of their leagues being disrupted by naughty FIFA and their Winter World Cup. Del Boy 2006 says, I am shocked the pod hasn't realised the influence Qatar have with the big European clubs and think the clubs will oppose a Winter World Cup. Where do all the big clubs go on winter breaks these days? Who sponsors Barca? Who owns PSG? Where is Al Jazeera, who spend more on European club football rights than anyone else, based? Just watch how European clubs, says Del Boy 2006, who normally go back crazy at the slightest change to the status quo, will have no problem facilitating Qatar's Winter World Cup. Del Boy 2006, I think you might have nailed that one. Just follow the money, as they say.
Well, yeah, just wait until kind of China pitch for the World Cup and decide to play all the games upside down or something.
Now, PSG in France go 5 points clear of Monaco after a 2-1 win away at bottom club Ajaccio, or basement Ajaccio, as I like to call them, while Claudio Ranieri's Monaco stumbled at Montpellier 1-1. Draw for them. Benfica have gone top after beating 2-0 at Stade Luz. All sorts of exciting, actually really quite emotional scenes there. All the Benfica players with Eusebio's name on the back of their shirts. And we keep getting flack over the fact that we didn't dedicate X number of minutes to a eulogy for Eusebio a week ago. So, you know.
Still not doing it.
No, I mean...
You could do, but you'd need to get somebody in here who's in the 60s who maybe saw him play at Goodison Park in the World Cup.
We'd largely be just repeating what you read in every other news outlet.
He was great on YouTube, wasn't he? And, you know, he looked fantastic.
Scottish news, Morton boss Kenny Shields no longer doing matchday interviews because his doctor says it makes him emotionally imbalanced. How about that?
And what was his... controversialised, he said.
Did he?
He said, I can't help but being controversialised when I do them.
Right.
Which is true, because he keeps getting banned, so...
Right. All right, well, probably best then.
Mm.
And let's go Serie A at this point, because I know, Paul, you were after your Norwich, after your inner turmoil, after the Norwich defeat, you sought solace in Spain and were sorely disappointed, no?
Well, it was a guy who quite often cheers me up about Norwich on Twitter. I said, you know, I'm going to have to get this out of my head. And he said, well, I'm going to just get back on the horse and watch some great Spanish football.
Oh, I thought you meant, you know, just jack up on Smack.
Well, that's somebody else recommended that, actually. Somebody recommended Ketamin. I think it was quite revealing of the people who follow me on Twitter and their preferences. But anyway, he was like, yeah, I'm going to get back on the horse, watch some quality football. Lo and behold, a tedious 0-0.
But luckily there was Sassuolo to save you and all those other sad Norwich fans out there. Right. Well, should we talk Serie A? Because the big news is that post-Sassuolo, Massimiliano Allegri is out at Milan. He had three full seasons there. They finished first, second and third in the first three of them. This last one, not so good. They are, is it 30 points? 30 points off the top in 11th place. But then you have to factor in the extraordinary clear out of players and talent that the club orchestrated at the beginning of last season. And as for who's next, that's the big question. It's really hard to say right now. There's all sorts of suggestions. Gazzetta dello Sport today going big with Pippo Inzaghi, who just yesterday was winning the youth derby of Milan 2-0 with his Primavera squad. Raphael Honigstein retweeting a German joke that by appointing Inzaghi, Berlusconi hopes to get the Milan fans on side again. Yeah, but the thing is that the other names in the frame are Andre Villas-Boas for some, a Prandelli, who says he's going to be moving on from Italy after the World Cup, and the man that some people say they've already booked and could come immediately from Botafogo, Seedorf, Clarence Seedorf. But as I say, Gazzetta dello Sport reckons it's going to be Inzaghi, at least in an interim role, which can be really interesting to see. The reason it's so hard to know what's going on is that there's a bit of a Game of Thrones-style war going on for control of the club between Galliani, we talked about this before, and Berlusconi's daughter, Barbara Berlusconi, BB, who lacks of her father's natural discretion and diplomacy and is wont to hammering out iron-toned communiques when things go bad. And indeed, yesterday, straight after the final whistle, she was hammering out, this is unacceptable, we must make a change. And pretty much the club's hand was forced at that point. So Allegri's gone. And later today, we're expecting the announcement of who's going to be taking over. Boy, it's going to be interesting.
Just while you're on the subject, because I know you're always keen, latest Game of Thrones news, there's a trailer for season 4.
I saw it. It's only 10 seconds long. Isn't it a trailer? It's longer than that.
It's an hour. It's a minute long.
Right. Yesterday morning, they put out a trailer
for the trailer.
Yeah.
Yeah, April. Oosh.
April, is it? Mm. All right, then. Well, on to this extraordinary game. You saw this, Paul, did you?
I'm afraid I YouTubed it.
Did you?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, well, basically, it was a pretty extraordinary story, this, because you had Sassuolo on one hand, who, population of 41,000. I was saying, I think they're the smallest in any of the top European divisions. Some people suggesting that Guingamp in France actually even smaller, but they're tiny anyway. And they were in the bottom three, had lost their previous four games, conceded eight, not scored any goals in that period. And coming up against a Milan side that seemed to have got its mojo back, fresh from a 3-0 victory. They had Kaká in good form, Cristante looking good, seven-time European champions, of course, and the new signing Honda on the bench ready to come on. And Milan went 2-0 up in the first 12 minutes, so it looked pretty much that we were set for another of those 7-0s that sometimes happen to Sassuolo. But instead, about a minute later, they'd score one through this young 19-year-old, well, most 19-year-olds now, this 19-year-old Domenico Berardi, who's hot young thing, etc. And then he got another, and another, brilliant goals. Suarez-esque, his second, actually, the way he kind of manages to, while falling over, lean round the defender and poke it in past the keeper.
I was going to say, what can you tell us about Berardi?
Well, what do you want to know?
Just, I mean, I know he's been talked of as a talent for a while, but...
Yeah.
Is it Juventus who own him?
Yeah, Juventus part own him, but effectively they own him. And effectively they bought him and are letting him stay at Sassuolo, but he came up through the ranks at Sassuolo. Mm. James Horncastle mentioned that the story, he didn't play organised football till he was 16.
Wow.
And he went to visit his brother who was at university and was just playing in a five-a-side game, and one of the other players there who has links with Sassuolo noticed him and said, listen, you should come down for a trial because you're actually quite good. And he's had a meteoric rise since. Was in the under-19 side certainly called up for the under-19s for Italy, and then got into a bit of hot water because he didn't turn up for one of the games because Sassuolo had a promotion playoff. So he decided to stay with them, and then he got a bit of a kind of unofficial suspension from the Italian national side. But he has been called up for the under-21s this week. And regarded as a potential inclusion in the World Cup squad because he ended up scoring four goals in this game, 19 years old, and absolute quality of the goals as well.
I fail to understand how someone aged 16 in Italy could not have played much football and go from nothing to...
He must have played at
some incredible level. It's incredible
that
shift.
Level.
What about Moreno, what's his name, Torricelli? Moreno Torricelli, who became a massive star, well, big player anyway, a big part of that, you know, multiple title winning side at Juventus, who was discovered. He was working in a wood factory or in a carpentry kind of warehouse thing, and he was playing amateur football, and somebody spotted him, I think maybe in his 20s. And so people slip through the net all over.
That's what Ian Wright always talks about on 606, about all these rough gems that are out there.
It happens. I'd say it's happening less and less these days with the scouting networks that clubs have got. So
right.
That is a particular find, though.
Anyway, it was an extraordinary game. And then basically they were 2-0 down. By the end of the first half, they were 3-2 up, all the goals from Berardi. He scored again at the start of the second half. It was now 4-2. Anyway, super climax to the game, because after Berardi had scored four, Milan looked completely out of sorts, shell-shocked. They bring on Keisuke Honda, who does pretty well and hits the post, and they get a little bit of belief back. They get a goal back in these final 5 minutes when Milan hit the post again, really dramatic. And then at the final whistle, the Sassuolo manager, Eusebio, nice tie in there, Di Francesco, who did look, prior to the game, the manager who was most likely to get the sack on Sunday, the players just go bonkers, and they're grabbing him, and they're shaking him, and it's just a raw explosion of kind of team spirit and joy. It was fantastic to watch. This great little story, that Sassuolo. And then they move out of the bottom three. Terrific.
Hats off to them.
Hats off. Yeah. Other quick bit of Serie A news. I mentioned the fact that David Moyes was at Cagliari to see Cagliari Juventus. Juve won that one 4-1. That's their 11th straight victory. That's their best ever run of victories ever in their history ever.
Wow.
Yeah. Even in the days of Moggi, they couldn't get 11 wins in a row. How about that? Verona played Napoli, and Napoli had a 3-0 win away at Verona. I mentioned this because, quite touchingly, one of the most famous ironic banners at a football match in Italy was years ago, I think back in the 80s, when Napoli fans, travelling Napoli fans, held up a banner to the Verona Ultras saying, Giulietta era una zoccola, which is Giulietta was a tart. Out of Romeo and Juliet. And so this time, the Verona fans held up, who've been really well behaved, by the way, this year. They've got a terrible reputation. This year, they've been among the best behaved. They held up a banner saying, Neapolitans, you are all figli of Giulietta. You're all sons of Giulietta.
It's amazing. 30 years on, they remember.
Oh, yeah, it's famous, that one. And there you go. Crikey. Anyway, now, should we dial up Sid? Because there's loads to talk about with our Spanish football expert after another big weekend of Spanish action and news.
Hello, Jimbo. I'm here.
Hey, where are you, Sid?
I'm in Madrid. How are you? Where are you?
Yeah,
you're in that near Earth orbit.
Very much so.
Sorry, Darth.
Yeah, we do. We're twinkling away there in the sky. Lovely. Sid, so many things to discuss. First of all, Pepe Mel. Who is he?
Well, he's the guy that when he was sacked from Betis, that ended his little record of being longest-serving manager in the First Division, who took Betis from the Second Division up to the First, a club that was in real crisis when he came in administration, no money, a real huge power vacuum, which he filled. He built a team based largely on youth team players over 3.5 years, 16 youth teamers given a first team game for Betis, including obviously two of the guys who are now at Swansea, Pozuelo and Cañas, including Adrián, the goalkeeper at West Ham, including Beñat, who's now a Spain international. Brought them up, survived relatively comfortably the first year, got into European place last year, but by the time he was sacked this year, of course, they were bottom of the table.
Right. Well,
he's very interesting as well. He's a published author.
Yes.
I don't know if this is necessarily a good thing, but he claims that his books have a touch of the Dan Brown about them. Hmm. And he also very famously, I think it was 2 years ago now, when it looked like his team was hovering a bit dangerously close to relegation, he announced that he would rather his daughter came home and said she was pregnant than find out that Betis were going to go down. Now, of course, at the time, his daughter, I think, was kind of 18, 19, something like that. I guess the response to that is surely it depends who the father is. And also what it did is it provoked a bit of a scramble of people on the internet trying to find pictures of his daughter.
Mm. Right, okay. Well, that's... I wonder if we'll come out with any similar comments at West Brom, because they're very much in the relegation battle. They're only 3 points off the drop as he comes in, and fresh from a 1-0 defeat away out to Southampton. It's interesting as well that certainly the English papers reporting that he came in with an ultimatum, saying, telling the Spanish media that he hadn't been allowed to bring his assistants, and if he wasn't allowed to install them at the end of this season, it would be impossible to continue there.
It's very strange, this. Pepe Mel had said that he'd initially turned West Brom down because they wouldn't let him go with his backroom staff. In the end, he accepted. I wonder how they feel about it. I wonder if they feel that they've been let down or whether they trust Mel to push for it at the end of the season. But it strikes me as unusual because a manager normally tries very hard not to lose that first battle, because if you start off, if you like, how would I best describe it, as a kind of imbalance of power against the club, then it's unlikely you're going to get it back again. So I must admit, I'm a little surprised by that.
All right. Is he any good, though? You think he's quite good?
Well, I mean, if you look at what he did at Betis, I mean, to be honest, what he did there was pretty extraordinary, given really, really difficult circumstances. He, as I say, he was determined to bring kids through. He had them playing really quite nice football. As a second division side, they beat Barcelona 3-1 in the Copa del Rey. Admittedly, they'd lost the first leg 5-0 at the Camp Nou. They were always good fun to watch. Defensively, occasionally a little bit ropey, but they were a really nice side to watch. And when things really started to go wrong at the start of this year, was in the summer they sold, I think, 14 players and bought in 12, completely new squad at a cost of only $3.5 million in total for those 12 players. And it felt like, I think it was the first time really, that the signings were being made purely by the sporting director. Clearly Mel wasn't completely enamoured with the players that he'd been given. His relationship with the club had turned a little bit as well. So I think if you ask any Betis fan pretty much what they think of him, they will say that they really liked him. And perhaps the proof of that is that on the day that his sacking was announced, he's there in the press room pretty close to tears and stuff. There's this noise that they keep hearing, this kind of thudding noise. And it turns out it's fans outside chucking rocks at the press room in protest at the fact that he'd been sacked.
Wow, that's pretty telling, isn't it? All right, super stuff. Well, now, Atletico Madrid against Barcelona was the headline game this weekend. Sid, what did you make of it?
Well, I must say I quite enjoyed it, but I know that a lot of other people didn't. Look, there's no doubt about it. It wasn't the game that we hoped it would be. It finished 0-0. There really weren't many shots on goal. I think it was two each in total in the end.
Why was that, Sid?
I think basically because both of them realised that the other team was really very good. And so they kind of, I know it's a cliche, but I think they had a bit too much respect for each other. I think they were concerned about being caught, and so I think they focused really quite closely on making sure that they weren't caught out. I think in a kind of implicit way, they were not that unhappy with a draw, both of them. Tactically, it was really interesting and it was very intense, and I quite enjoyed it for that reason, but it wasn't the expansive game that maybe people hoped for. And I imagine, to be honest, that watching it on TV, it probably didn't feel like much of a game, whereas in the stadium with the noise and the tension, that sense that any moment now this could, you know, something really big could happen, I think made it more exciting than perhaps it would otherwise have been.
Right. One man who did enjoy it, Carlo Ancelotti.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sure Carlo Ancelotti would have loved it. He had been maybe not public about this, but he was very clear that he wanted it to be a draw. It helped Real Madrid out, as you know. They then beat Espanyol last night. That now means that three teams within 3 points, which of course also means that with the second half of the season to go, and it doesn't matter this half of the season because you play everyone once and then you play everyone once again, so it's the halfway stage, everyone's played everyone. In the second half of the season, all three teams, in theory at least, have the league title in their hands.
Wow.
Because, of course, if they win their own games, they don't depend on anyone else. But that's because they face each other, obviously.
Got it. Okay, cool. All right, let's talk a little bit about transfer news. Man United linked with the Spanish players, or players from Spain. They sent Phil Neville out to see Rayo Vallecano this weekend for Atleti's 19-year-old midfielder Sal Niguez, is it?
Sal, who's on loan from Atletico Madrid at Rayo, has played a lot of the season in all sorts of different positions. He's even played at centre-back, which really isn't his natural position. He's very, very highly rated, and he's been watched for quite a while by quite a lot of English clubs. I must confess, I don't know whether there's any mileage in this happening now, but he is someone who people are interested in. And as you say, Phil Neville was out at Getafe on Sunday lunchtime to see him. I wonder if there might be one or two other players he'd be looking at as well, although right. Actually thinking about the Getafe and Rayo sides, I can't imagine who else would be likely to interest an English club.
Does he have attitude, this fellow Niguez?
Oh dear, oh dear.
Well, that's it for today's pod. We're back on Thursday. Paul, thanks for stopping by again.
Part of the problem.
Happy trails. Cheers, Greg.
Cheers, James.
Thank you, Sean. And well done, by the way.
Cheers, James.
Because you by the simple expedient of not saying anything for two-thirds of the pod, have managed to beat producer Ben with your I won't mention gambling bet, which is that ironic? I think it might
be. It is ironic. That's irony.
That's irony. All right. Cheers, everyone. Cheers, producer Ben. Cheers, listeners. See you on Thursday.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.